I. L. Baldwin, professor of agricultural bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin, had this to say.
The possible indirect harmful effects of pesticides on human and wildlife are stressed in Silent Spring. It is noted that certain of the pesticides may serve as carcinogens and that some may serve as mutagens. How often all the necessary conditions are met so that pesticides do actually serve as carcinogens or mutagens is unknown. The author feels that such dangers are very great. Most scientists who are familiar with the field, including government workers charged with the responsibility of safeguarding the public health, feel that the danger of damage is slight. The author gives no figures for deaths known to be due to pesticides, but her description of certain cases may leave the impression with the uninformed reader that such cases of death due to the direct effects of pesticides are numerous. Actually, human deaths in the United States known to be caused by pesticides are less than 100 annually. To place this in proper perspective, consider that almost twice that many deaths are known to be caused by aspirin, and that almost one-half as many deaths are known to be caused by bee stings. Another example in which the author's choice of language may lead to false impressions is her reference to the fall of chemical death rain. Many may be led to believe that just as rain falls on all of our land, so is all of our land sprayed with pesticides. Actually, less than 5% of all the area of the United States is annually treated with insecticides. The story of Silent Spring, so well told by Rachel Carson, even though it presents only one side of a very complex problem, will serve a useful purpose if research on better methods of pest control is stimulated, and if all concerned with the production, control, and use of pesticides are stimulated to exercise greater care in the protection of the public welfare. In the meantime, it is my hope that some equally gifted writer will be willing to do the necessary research and to write the even more dramatic story of the values conferred on mankind by the chemical revolution of the last two decades.
Florida has experienced so many poisonings recently that the state is now attempting to control and to curtail the use of some of the more dangerous pesticides in residential areas. It's also worthy of notice that during the years 1959, 1960, and 1961, airplane crashes involving crop dusting planes totaled 873. In these accidents, 135 pilots lost their lives. This very fact led to some very significant research by the Federal Aviation Agency through its Civil Aeromedical Unit. This research, which has just been reported on in brief, was designed to find out why so many of these planes crashed. And these medical investigators took as their basic premise the assumption that spray poisons do accumulate within the body of the pilot, that they accumulate within the cell where they are difficult to detect. Now, the report that was recently issued contained two very significant facts, which the researchers had confirmed. One, that there is a causal relation between the buildup of toxins in the cell and the onset of sugar diabetes. Two, that the buildup of poisons within the cell interferes with the rate of energy production in the human body. I, of course, am happy to have this confirmation that cellular processes are not so irrelevant as a certain scientific reviewer of Silent Spring has declared them to be.
Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, in an interview with Mimi Rosenberg.
The oil companies are the ones that produce the pesticides, and they're just going to stop at no end. Malathion, to this day, nobody knows what malathion does. It's related to the parathion that was used in Germany, you know, in the nerve gases. I mean, it's a very dangerous poison, but here they sprayed it all over everything. I mean, it's crazy. But it shows the dangers of government. And again, why we have to participate. We just cannot afford to not get involved politically. It's just too big of a risk.
William J. Darby, head of the Department of Biochemistry and director of the Division of Nutrition at Vanderbilt University, criticized Miss Carson's language and her scholarship.
Silent Spring starts with a bit of dramatic description of a situation which the author then acknowledges does not actually exist. It then orients the reader to its subject matter by stating that only within the present century has man acquired significant power to alter the nature of his world. It identifies as irrevocable and, for the most part, irreversible, the effects of this now universal contamination of the environment in which chemicals are the sinister and little recognized partners of radiation in changing the very nature of the world, the very nature of life itself. Man has, according to Miss Carson, now upset that ideal state of adjustment and balance of life on this planet through synthetic creations of man's inventive mind, brewed in his laboratory and having no counterpart in nature. These products, the reader is told, are staggering in number, have power to kill, have incredible potential for harm, represent a train of disaster, result in chemical death rain, and are being used with little or no advance investigation of their effect on soil, water, wildlife, and man himself. She further warns the reader that all of these sinister chemicals will not only extinguish plant life, wildlife, aquatic life, and man, but they will produce cancer, leukemia, sterility, and cellular mutations. There are 297 pages devoted to reiteration of these views. There then follows a 55-page list of principal sources, designed to impress the reader with the extent of the support for Miss Carson's views. This list uses an extender and is artificially colored and flavored. Its apparent bulk is made one-third greater through devoting a line of type to identify each page on which a source bears, and by repeating in full the title of each source in relation to recurrent pages. Its bulk will appeal to those readers who are as uncritical as the author, or to those who find the flavor of her product to their taste. These consumers will include the organic gardeners, the anti-fluoride leaguers, the worshippers of natural foods, those who cling to the philosophy of a vital principle, and other pseudo-scientists and faddists. The public may be misled by this book. If it stimulates the public to press for unwise and ill-conceived restrictions on the production, use, or development of new chemicals, it will be the consumer who suffers. If, on the other hand, it inspires some users to read and heed labels more carefully, it may aid in the large educational effort in which industry, government, colleges, and many other groups are engaged, despite Miss Carson's implication that they are not. The responsible scientist should read this book to understand the ignorance of those writing on the subject and the educational task which lies ahead.
And this same reviewer, writing in a chemical journal, was much annoyed with me for giving the sources of my information. To identify the person whose views you are quoting is, according to this reviewer, name-dropping. Well, times have certainly changed since I received my training in scientific methods at Johns Hopkins. My critic also disapproved profoundly of my bibliography. The very fact that it gave complete and specific references for each important statement was extremely distasteful to him. This was padding, he said, to impress the uninitiated with its length. Now, I would just like to say that in Silent Spring, I've never asked the reader to take my word. I have given him a very clear indication of my sources. I make it possible, indeed I urge him, to go beyond what I report to get the full picture. And this is the reason for the 55 pages of references. You can't do this if you're trying to conceal or distort or present half-truths. Another reviewer was offended because I made the statement that it is customary for pesticide manufacturers to support research on chemicals in the universities. Now, this is just common knowledge, and I can scarcely believe that the reviewer was unaware of it because his own university is among those receiving such grants. But since my statement has been challenged, I suggest that any of you who are interested make a few inquiries from representative universities, and I am sure you will find that the practice is very widespread. In fact, a visit to any good science library will provide the evidence, because it is customary in technical papers for the authors to acknowledge the source of their funds. Just an example or two gleaned at random from the Journal of Economic Entomology. A paper from the University of Wisconsin carries the note, "This research was also supported in part by grants from the Shell Chemical Company, Velsicol Chemical Corporation, and Wisconsin Canners Association." Another paper from the Illinois Natural History Survey declares this investigation was sponsored by the Monsanto Chemical Company of St. Louis, Missouri. A penetrating observer of social problems has pointed out recently that whereas wealthy families once were the chief benefactors of the universities, now industry has taken over this role. Now, of course, supportive education is something no one quarrels with, but this need not blind us to the fact that research supported by the pesticide manufacturers is not likely to be directed at discovering facts unfavorable to the continuance of current practices. Such a liaison between science and industry is a growing phenomenon, but seen in other areas as well. For example, the American Medical Association, through its newspaper, has just referred physicians to a pesticide trade association for information to help them answer patients' questions about the effects of pesticides on man. Now, I am sure physicians have a need for greater information on this subject, but I would like to see them referred to authoritative scientific or medical literature and not to a trade organization whose interest it is to promote the sale of pesticides. We see scientific societies acknowledging as sustaining associates a dozen or more giants of a related industry. Now, when the scientific organization speaks, whose voice do we hear? The voice of science or the voice of industry? It might be a less serious situation if this were clarified, for I think the public assumes it is hearing the voice of science.
And Frederick J. Stare, chairman of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard, criticized her scientific detachment.
Since food faddists, theater critics, news commentators, and other self-appointed protectors of the public welfare have written critical estimates of Silent Spring, Miss Rachel Carson's controversial book on the effect of agricultural chemicals on man's environment, there seems to be no reason to bar a research chemist and physician whose principal interest is food and nutrition, particularly since a very large part of Miss Carson's work touches on the matter of the safety and wholesomeness of our food supply. Though I strongly disagree with Miss Carson's central conclusions, undoubtedly she has rendered a service by obliquely arousing an apathetic, unscientific public to a most serious problem, providing enough food for an exploding population and protecting man from the scourge of epidemic disease. However, I doubt that this was her purpose. Her book is an emotional picture of the disaster we possibly caught through our wide-scale use of agricultural chemicals, and is filled with horrendous examples of how pesticides are polluting our rivers, destroying wildlife, and impairing the health of human beings. Throughout, she asserts that we are destroying the balance of nature and ourselves in the process, and that we must adopt a radically new approach or consign ourselves to certain death. Miss Carson writes with passion and with beauty, but with very little scientific detachment, dispassionate scientific evidence and passionate propaganda are two buckets of water that simply can't be carried on one person's shoulder. The bucket that springs a leak in Miss Carson's case is the scientific evidence. Through omission and commission, the only two ways to commit sin, Miss Carson flounders as a scientist in this book.
And what does it mean when we see a committee set up to make a supposedly impartial review of a situation and then discover that the committee is affiliated with the very industry whose profits are at stake? I have just this week read two reviews of the recent reports of a National Academy of Sciences committee on the relations of pesticides to wildlife. These comments, these reviews on these reports raise rather disturbing questions. It's important to understand what this committee is. The two sections of its report that have now been published are frequently cited by the pesticide industry in attempts to refute my statements. The public, I believe, assumes that the committee is actually part of the academy. It is appointed by the academy, but its members come from outside. Some, of course, are scientists of distinction in their fields. But one would suppose that the way to get an impartial evaluation of such a problem, the impact of pesticides on wildlife, would be to set up a committee of completely disinterested individuals. Now, the review that appears this week in the Atlantic Naturalist describes the composition of this committee as follows. A very significant role in this committee is played by the liaison representatives. These are of three categories: A, supporting agencies; B, government agencies; C, scientific societies. The supporting agencies are presumably those who supply the hard cash. 43 such agencies are listed, including 19 chemical companies comprising the massed might of chemical industry. In addition, there are at least four trade organizations, such as the National Agricultural Chemical Association and the National Aviation Trades Association. The committee reports begin with a firm statement in support of the use of chemical pesticides. From this predetermined position, it is not surprising to find it mentioning only some damage to some species of wildlife. And since in what appears to be the modern manner there is no documentation, one can neither confirm nor deny these findings. The Atlantic Naturalist reviewer described these reports as, quotes, written in the style of a trained public relations official of industry out to placate some segments of the public that were causing trouble, end quote. All these things raise the question of the communication of scientific knowledge to the public.
In the 2 years which have elapsed since the not-so-silent spring of the publication of Rachel Carson's articles, her warnings have been grimly illustrated. 10 million fish died of endrin and dieldrin poisoning in the Mississippi River. Parathion poisoning reached epidemic proportions among orchard workers in Stanislaus County, California, and evidence of insect resistance to insecticides continues to grow. Influential groups and agencies have called for more stringent control over the use of pesticides. Hearings have been held and companies have been investigated.
The earth has a problem with a hard drug, and we are among the victims. That drug is the pesticide DDT and its breakdown products. This chemical used to be a good trip. It saved millions of people from death by malaria, typhus, and other insect-borne diseases, and it saved billions of dollars in crops from insect pests. Now we are finding out that DDT has been doing a whole lot of other things, subtle things, like killing animals because it keeps them from reproducing. The trouble is that the pushers, the men who make money by selling this land drug, mostly in California, have got us hooked. They sell it to us, and worse yet, to underdeveloped nations all over the world, many of whom do not use it as cautiously as we do. It may ruin them in the end. DDT is a funny thing. It can last for decades because it doesn't fall apart like other chemicals. Thus, the world is on a bum trip now from which it may not recover. Secondly, it evaporates with water and enters the winds, so it spreads itself over the whole world. Thirdly, it clings to small particles, so it gets eaten easily by animals. And finally, it magnifies itself in animals. It exists in low concentrations in water, but plants and animals collect it selectively, and as it moves up the food chain from plant-eating animals to animals that eat other animals, it gets more and more concentrated. We found out that DDT can reduce the photosynthesis and growth of plankton, and it's already reached a high enough level in some bays to do this. Marine plankton is where most of the world's oxygen comes from. It has begun to damage oysters and shrimps. Crab fisheries on both coasts of the United States have declined, and DDT is the reason. Carnivorous fish in enclosed seas and lakes have started to exceed the legal limit of DDT for human consumption. The Lake Michigan coho salmon is already too contaminated to eat. Marine fishes on our coast are getting close to the legal limit. Some freshwater fish, such as trout in some areas of the country, that are supposedly still safe to eat are suffering reproductive damage, so there are fewer and fewer of them. And we are beginning to suspect that some marine fish, such as the salmon, are not behaving correctly because of very low DDT concentrations. The worst damaged animals are the birds. Do you like those funny-looking fish-eating birds with the big sacks under their long necks, the pelicans? Well, take a good look now, because no matter what happens, you are probably not going to see them much longer. None of them on the California coast laid eggs this year. They laid omelets. Their calcium balance is messed up by DDT. We may lose the peregrine falcon, the bald eagle, the osprey, the petrels, and perhaps a whole lot more.
Rachel Carson died on April 14, 1964, a little less than 2 years after the publication of Silent Spring. The ideas which she expressed in the opening paragraphs of The Edge of the Sea formed her conceptual framework, and they were part of the working vocabulary of the biological scientist. But with the publication of Silent Spring, these ideas entered into the popular vocabulary, and in so doing became part of the complex environment she so beautifully described. Rachel Carson has affected that environment in ways not yet possible to assess.
We are faced with a life and death need, not just to find new technological means of suppressing this plant or that animal, but to acquire the basic knowledge of animal populations and their relation to their surroundings that will promote an even balance and damp down the explosive power of outbreaks and new invasions. Much of the necessary knowledge is now available, but we do not use it. Have we fallen into a mesmerized state that makes us accept as inevitable that which is inferior and detrimental, as though we had lost the will or vision to demand that which is good? Such thinking, in the words of the American ecologist Paul Shepard, idealizes life with only its head out of the water, inches above the limits of toleration of the corruption of its own environment. And then he goes on to ask, why should we tolerate a diet of weak poisons, a home in insipid surroundings, a circle of acquaintances who are not quite our enemies, the noise of motors with just enough relief to prevent insanity? Who would want to live in a world which is just not quite fatal?
I guess the important thing is that she renewed or reassured us of the importance of the evolutionary force that we may have forgotten. She reminds us that if we compare technology with the evolutionary force, we're comparing maybe two centuries with forever. And in the course of a century or two, with some very bright thinking and writing and research, we think we can second guess all that. And I guess some of the chemical companies thought so more than others. that in order to sustain an ever-increasing population, that we should feel perfectly free to eradicate any other living thing that seems to be competing with us.
Is industry becoming a screen through which facts must be filtered so that the hard, uncomfortable truths are kept back and only the harmless morsels are allowed to filter through? I know that many thoughtful scientists are deeply disturbed that their organizations are becoming fronts for industry. More than one scientist has raised the question of whether a spirit of Lysenkoism may be developing in America today. The philosophy that perverted and destroyed the science of genetics in Russia and even infiltrated all of that nation's agricultural sciences. But here, the tailoring, the screening of basic truth, is done not to suit any party line, but to accommodate to the short-term gain to serve the gods of profit and production.
You've been listening to From the Vault, an original Pacifica Radio Archives production created by Brian DeShazer and Christopher Sprinkle. All the clips that you heard in this program of From the Vault are from the Pacifica Radio Archives, including Rachel Carson from her 1962 speech to the Women's National Press Club in Washington, D.C., Upton Sinclair from a 1962 speech to students at Claremont College, California, Cesar Chavez from a 1968 speech to students at New York City College, Dolores Huerta from an interview with Mimi Rosenberg, marine biologist Eugene Cohn of the Sierra Club from a 1969 address, Rachel Carson, a memorial produced by Joan McIntyre. From the Vault is broadcast throughout the Pacifica Radio Network with our 110 stations and affiliates. This program was produced by Haunani Singer and Mark Torres, executive producer Brian DeShazer, and the Pacifica Radio Archives. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. For more information, call the Pacifica Radio Archives, 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment of the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Music used in this program was Antonio Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, and other songs were from the 1979 original soundtrack recording of the musical Hair. Thanks for listening.